720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth. Chilling with you till 3 o'clock. Thanks for being with us today. I hope that you are outside and enjoying some of this beautiful sunshine. Holy moly, it's gorgeous. It's record-breakingly warm is what it is, but it's really, really gorgeous. And I hope you are you're downloading that WGN Radio app and or maybe your iHeartRadio app so you can head outside with it because we're portable like that. It's all good. Anyway, hanging with you till 3 o'clock today. We've got lots and lots of stuff to talk about today. We're going to talk with Lisa Dietland, who is the founder of the Institute for Transformational Philanthropy. Say that three times fast. Now I've got it together. Sorry about that. Hi, Lisa. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, Amy. How are you? Happy February. Is it summer?
I was going to say, by February, you mean May, right?
I have the windows open and the sun streaming in, and it's absolutely amazing.
I know. It's so lovely. There's so many people out walking around on Michigan Avenue today, and it is so, so lovely. So every time you join us on the show, we're always so grateful because you always bring so much information that you have there at the Institute for Transformational Philanthropy. And today is no exception. Of course, a lot of people are talking about giving in meaningful ways right now. A lot of things are in the news these days. And so
a lot of people are
saying, you know, give to this group, give to here, give to this, do this. And it's a little overwhelming, probably more than ever. A lot of people are feeling more politically engaged, more attached to causes that are important to them. And so how do you make a plan that is a little bit less reactionary, perhaps a bit more thoughtful, where you can, stretch those dollars and make them count more and all of those things? Where do you even start to plan for the year when things change moment to moment right now?
Well, I always say have a plan, put it in writing. If it's not in writing, it doesn't exist. And people go, oh, gosh, it's a beautiful day. Why would you say that? But the truth of the matter is you should sit down and think about what do you want to do so you don't let guilt drive your philanthropic decisions. You know, we all have those situations where we're at an event or we're invited and we're filling out a table and all of a sudden it comes time for the pal raise and it's really not a cause you care about and you're feeling guilty because you're there and you ate a dinner, you had a glass of wine, and you feel like you should give. So I always say we're smart shoppers, let's be smart donors. And the way to start is, first of all, think about what did you do last year? Most of us give to our a house of worship or an alma mater or maybe our child's school. There's usually two or three that we always give to every single year. And then we have some others. You might love animals. On a beautiful day like today, people might be out walking animals for paws or, the Anti-Cruelty Society or what have you, thinking about adopting a puppy or a cat or what have you. What is really important to you? Then second, look at your finances. How much do you want to donate this year? Most people think, oh, gosh, we have to give all the money in November and December. But as you've heard me say, Amy, there are rivers to clean up in the spring. There are books to put on library shelf in the fall. There are kids that are hungry in the summer. There are seniors that need help in the winter. So, think about what do you want. Do you want to do $100 a month? Do you want to do $1,000 a year? $1,000 a year is $83 a month, $21 a week, $3 a day.
Much more doable when you break it down like that.
Most of us could give $3 a day. We could give up that expensive coffee once a day. We might have it the other two times in the day, but we could give it up. The other thing that I'm sharing with people right now that I'm working with is some folks are getting a tax return. That we're starting to do our taxes and we're starting to gather our receipts. And think about designating part of your tax refund. If you get a tax refund, maybe say, I'm going to donate 50% of it to a cause I care about that just came up because of whatever politically is going on in your world and whatever side of the aisle you fall on.
And what about those moments where we see, the unexpected? So we've made our plan, we've set our budget for giving, but something happens. Say maybe there's something changes politically, or maybe there's a natural disaster, something we didn't see coming. Where do we then kind of scrimp on the rest of what we've set aside for the year, or do we move that? Do we just kind of move things around and make it happen, or do we just figure that out later?
Great question. I was thinking about Girl Scout cookies. If you're like me, you get hit up and they're not in your budget. You're going to be on a diet, you're trying to be healthy, and all of a sudden the Girl Scouts show up at your door and you say, yeah, I'll buy, five boxes, and the bill comes and you're like, wait a minute, what was I thinking? So it can be something, as happy as Girl Scout cookies or as disastrous as what happens when a hurricane or a tornado hits. You know, Americans are considered the most generous individuals in the world. We dig deep. And even when, if you remember Hurricane Sandy that hit in the East Coast, in New Jersey and New York especially, it hit in the fall, the late fall, and people were really afraid that that would cut into the year-end giving that we do in November and December, and it didn't. Actually, Americans reach in, they reach into their savings, they think about, you know, skipping a meal once a week, you know, that extra meal that you go out to eat and say, no, let's order in pizza, or I can make something, everyone come over to my house. Or they think about different ways that maybe instead of buying a new pair of shoes, they can have those shoes, you know, fixed by a cobbler and donate that money. They think about giving circles. I've heard of this wonderful way of giving that's, I learned about it from Western Michigan in the Muskegon area, that 200 women get together every month. And they each agree that every month they're going to donate $100. And they invite three or four nonprofits to come in and present. And then those nonprofits leave. And the women who happen to be attending that meeting, not all 200 attend, vote. And the organization that wins or gets the most votes gets $20,000 or $22,000. Well, by 200 women coming together and saying, I'm going to give $100 a month. They have wine, they have cheese, they have fun, they make friendships, they make work relationships, and they turn it into the fabric of their life. They just do it as a way of doing business, of doing good, and of giving back.
Very Shark Tank style, right? When you have people
yeah.
come in to present to you. I feel like it would be so easy to want to give to all of them.
Well, it is. That's the hard part. But, you know, people can come back and present the next month, and obviously there's recommendations, and it's rare that an organization gets it twice because there are so many nonprofit organizations. As you and I have talked, you know, there are 1.6 million nonprofits registered in the United States. That's about tripled since the late 90s when I became aware of philanthropy. And everyone thinks they should form a new nonprofit if they have a new idea. And I actually encourage people to look at the community trust or the community fund in their neighborhood. So like here in Chicago, we have the Chicago Community Trust. It's a place where you can achieve your goals by donating your money and having them manage it, but you're really still doing good.
Excellent idea for sure. We have to take a little break, but we're talking with Lisa Dietlin, who is the founder of the Institute for Transformational Philanthropy. She helps us get giving right. That's what she does. She helps us do it smartly and well and really stretch those dollars. But it's not always all about dollars. It's about our time too. And when we come back from break, we're going to talk about that, about how there are other ways that we can give of ourselves. And also when we do give money, how we can make sure we're doing it in a smart way, because there are so many organizations out there, so many worthy ones, but sometimes we want to make sure, right? We always want to make
right.
sure how our dollars are being spent, and sometimes we think it's being spent way and it's being spent a different way. So we're going to figure out how to check all of that good stuff out when we come back on 720 WGN. That's an appropriate song because we're talking all about philanthropy. We're talking with Lisa Dietlin, the founder of the Institute for Transformational Philanthropy and frequent contributor to this program for sure. We always like to have Lisa on with us because she brings with her so much information. And we've been talking about how to make a plan for the year for giving so that you can not just kind of swing it or sort of scramble throughout the year. And although for sure there will be things that come up, disasters happen where we have to kind of band together. But as we say that, sometimes there's just not always money to give. You know, sometimes we're all doing our best here, but nonetheless, like some months are just tight. And
right.
and nonetheless, there are still people that need to be fed and people that need shelter when disaster strikes and all of those things. And I really enjoy that your message at Institute for Transformational Philanthropy so often is that it's not just about money, that there are goods, there are time, there's all ways to give.
There is. You know, most people, when they see me coming, run. No, I'm joking. They don't run. Yeah, she's going to want money. But oftentimes I'm saying to them, you know, when we are having dinner or lunch and having a discussion, make a holistic plan. You know, what are you doing with your time? Actually, most people, when I talk to them, Amy, say giving of time is even more precious than writing a check because we all have the same 24 hours. It's what are we going to do with it? And to find a cause that's worthy of your time in your mind, and then to have the cause, meaning you show up and you're not sitting around for an hour and a half of your 3-hour shift waiting to be told what to do. So it's on both sides. But volunteering your time, most people do think about the food pantries and wanting to make meals and serve meals to people who are homeless or don't have food in the fall. But what about the people today who are in the hospital and not feeling well, or at the VA and maybe need a visit? The children in a children's hospital that, you know, some of the hospitals have actually game night or that you can play games with the kids. How about a library program? Kids that are restless today and, you know, their parents signed them up for a library program. Or the Boy Scouts. I just saw a friend of mine, you know, they do those Pinewood Derby racing, and they always need volunteers. Obviously, you can do things like donate blood. You could donate household goods. People go, what? And I go, well, who really needs 24 paper towels when the 24-pack that you get from Costco, you know? You go and you buy them because it's a great deal, but you get home and you're like, oh, my gosh, where am I going to store them? Well, think about all the things a nonprofit office needs. They usually have coffee and sugar and cream and coffee cups and napkins, and they need toilet paper and paper towels and Kleenex. And why don't maybe when you are at a Costco or a big, you know, super club where you're getting volume, think about donating half of that to a nonprofit organization. Call ahead, see if they need that, but that helps them take it off their budget. And for you, if you're strapped, but you're still financially, but you're still buying those household goods, allows you to give. A friend of mine, her son was going to school, and when he was in grade school, and they wanted to be green, and they didn't want to use paper towels. And she said the teacher asked her if she would buy a set of hand towels. It was a younger class, like a set for a towel for the sink for the morning and a towel for the sink for the afternoon. My friend loves to shop. She said, I'll do better than that. I have a coupon. I will buy 10 towels. 5 for the morning every day of the week and 5 for the afternoon. The teacher was blown away. Never thought that a parent would do that. It fed her soul. She loves to shop. She had a coupon. And they were able to be green in the classroom by using hand towels, not paper towels.
There you have it. There's all kinds of ways to help, for sure. And very important to note, as you often do, about checking out the organizations that you're giving to make sure they really do align with your values. I know we talk about this a lot around October when everything turns pink. But in fact, sometimes things are just pink and nothing is actually going to support anything having to do with breast cancer. And so you have some resources of places where people can check out exactly what that charity is doing and how their money is being spent.
Right. As I tell my friends and my clients, I say, you know, every single one of those 1.6 million nonprofits registered in the U.S. think they're doing really good work. And probably the majority of them are, but they might not be doing what you want to do. So we think about pink. You might want to support breast cancer research, but your friend might want to support, you know, support services or a helpline or a hotline or what have you. And you have to be a really smart donor. So three sources I always recommend. One is GuideStar. GuideStar is easy to find online, guidestar.org, and you can put in the name of the nonprofit organization, or if you don't know, like I was just in Idaho, say I wanted to support a group in Idaho, I could say, you know, Young Girls Leadership Program, Idaho, and it would bring up the organizations that say that in their mission, that that's what they do. Then you can check those out. So if people are listening and they go, gosh, you know, I want to support my hometown, but I, you know, I don't know anybody there, there's an easy way. Then you have Charity Navigator. Charity Navigator does primarily national organizations, and it has a star rating, sort of like, you know, the Zagat's in the restaurant book, you know, 1 to 5. We were very critical of them a few years ago because they just measured on return of dollar, meaning how much was going to program, not understanding that there are other levels of complexity to the nonprofit, but they're doing a lot better in measuring holistically. And then the third is the Better Business Bureau's Wise Giving Alliance. Most people don't realize they have a charitable side of the house.
All good resources for sure. So everybody head to those. We will put them up on the website when this podcast is up so you can find them on WGNradio.com. And then Lisa, I also want to ask you about, you know, right now I think a lot of people are doing soul searching as the political climate is changing really rapidly. And I think there's a little bit of kind of pull, maybe a little bit of inherent tension in some things people are you know, prompted to support. In particular, I'm seeing a lot of conversations on social media and hearing a lot of people talking about, well, do I have, you know, $20, do I give that to to support a family who's hungry tonight, or do I put that into an organization that's working to eradicate poverty, or is there another option I'm not thinking of? You know, I tend to want to go to the urgency, like that example in particular. Of course, you want to feed people who are hungry, but there is something to be said for really supporting the underlying cause of why so many charities even have to exist. Where do you fall on things like that?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. That was the premise, what came out of my first book in studying entrepreneurs and how they give away money. And all of them recognize the importance of charity, giving a person something to eat today, donating that $20 so that family next door can eat today. But they really wanted to solve the long-term problem. Why is there poverty? Why is there economic disparity? What can we do to resolve that? But they were smart enough to say, we have to feed these people today. So I think there's a couple things you can do. One is, this is an excellent time to begin thinking about, do you really want to give to those causes you've always been giving to? Or has something come to your attention in this political climate, this highly charged climate that has friends becoming foes and people not speaking to each other? If you want to just really do good in the world, maybe you want to shift. Maybe you say, I want to give $20. I'm going to give $15 to feed that family, but I'm going to give $5 to solve the issue of poverty. That you're actually shifting and you're letting go of some things that maybe aren't under attack or aren't as of vital importance in our society right now, given everything that's changing. I think there's nothing wrong. We've talked a lot about, you know, the nonprofit sector can be divided into those organizations that lift people up, that lift things up, or those that try to eradicate. You know, you think about scholarships and art and museums and things that lift and bring positivity to our community. And then you think about those that get rid of hunger and illness and disease.
The lift up versus the lift up, right? That's an interesting way to categorize them. But I think perhaps there are even subcategories within that, right? Of this is more the long term play of eradicating this underlying cause or lifting up some cause that needs more attention on it versus kind of an addressing an immediate need. There's sort of the long game and the short game.
Correct. And, you know, always take a deep breath. Take a deep breath. As much as you don't let guilt drive your philanthropic decisions, don't let high emotion and highly charged conversations drive it either. I mean, it's important that we are having these conversations, but remember what's important to you. You know, look at your values. What are you passionate about? What is your budget? Where do you want to support? Locally, nationally, globally? And then make decisions. And all decisions are good when we're talking philanthropy.
For sure. And of course, make yourself do real research. Don't say, I think this organization does this or supported this. Look at Snopes, look at whatever, do a Google search, because sometimes there are false narratives out there sometimes. So we want to make sure we check out those organizations and, of course, go to those resources that Lisa mentioned to check out to make sure those dollars align with where you want them to. So thank you, Lisa. Always
a
joy.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Always a joy to have you with us. Everybody, head to the Institute for Transformational Philanthropy to read more about Lisa Dietlin, the founder, and what she does, and all of the knowledge that she is always nice enough to come share with us. Thanks so much. Have a great Saturday.
You too, dear. Take care.
All right. We're going to take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with YA author Julie Hammerly. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, hanging with you till 3 o'clock today. Thanks so much for being with us. I'm seeing your tweets about the guest we had on a little bit earlier in the show, Lisa Dietlin. I will tweet out links to all the things that she mentioned, and we will put them up at WGNradio.com on the podcast page after the show. Don't worry, we got your back. Moving along, though, we now have a very special guest with us. Julie Hammerly is a regular guest. We've had her on a couple times before, and she is a young adult author, and she is doing all the things. I'm not sure how she quite does it all, but nonetheless, she's doing lots of things, and she joins us now by phone. Julie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So you have done a lot of writing lately because Sound of Us is out, and then the first book of the North Pole, Minnesota series, Any Boy But You, is out like a week ago, and you got two more coming out this year. How you doing?
I'm hanging in there. it's been kind of crazy. Like my new book came out this week on Monday, and I had to turn in edits on the second book yesterday. So it's just been like, go, go, go.
That's like the greatest part of writing a book, and some of the scariest part of writing a book all in one week there.
Yeah.
When the book comes out and when you have to turn in edits on the next one, for sure. Well, congratulations to you. It's really wonderful to see all of this stuff happening. Well, let's start with the brand new book. Tell us about that book, the first in the series.
Okay, so the North Pole, Minnesota series, it's set in a small town that's Christmas themed, as you can kind of tell from the name.
Year round.
And yes. And so the first one is actually takes place like post holidays in January and February, when things in the town have kind of like slowed down and it's just the locals. And it's about two high school kids, because they're all YA books, who are in a like kind of a family feud. Their families have hated each other for generations, and they sort of fall in love. You've got mail style playing this like kind of Pokemon Go-esque type game in the town.
Mm-hmm.
So they start chatting online, not realizing who they're talking to, and hijinks ensue.
Well, you know, I love this kind of this running theme through your writing, and I think you mentioned this even in your bio on your website, is about how you really frame your young adult writing for, I think your words are, nerds, geeks, and basket cases falling in love, which is great, because I think so often, when we think about the books, books tend to play to the most mainstream characters possible. So anytime you're speaking to maybe a group that might feel a little marginalized or is marginalized, it's always it always is an extra element to the story, maybe even kind of almost like a character, you know, a defining characteristic in and of itself.
Yeah, and especially my first book, The Sound of Us, which I feel like the main character is basically me when I was 17, you know, just trying to figure it out. And very anxious, and also like, you know, a little bit low on the self-esteem, you know, all that kind of stuff. And in this new one, I found that the male character is like he's kind of socially anxious, hides behind his computer, you know, that kind of thing. Not necessarily like the like big brawny Fabio
right.
type of romantic lead or anything like that. Because, you know, nerds need love as well.
Sure, everyone does. Every pot has its lid, as they
say. Exactly.
For sure. Well, Sound of Us takes place at, it's a summer camp. And I think that's I love the idea that she's, you know, so responsible, and she's always done all the things she was expected to do. And then kind of this mysterious drummer guy throws a wrench into that a bit.
She's kind of been pulled along, I think. You know, the main character, Kiki, sort of gets, like, dragged along on this, like, I'm going to be an opera singer, which is kind of a bizarre thing to get dragged along to, I guess. But, you know, she's always sung. She's always been kind of told that this is what you want to do. This is who you are. And then she gets to the camp, and it's not really who she is. And, yeah, Jack, the drummer, sort of kind of helps her see that.
Sure, sure.
For
right. As romances do.
Yeah.
So how did you land with the young adult genre?
I've always been, like, I know it was kind of popular. It started getting popular, like, in the last, I don't know, 10 years, young adult. But I've always just been, like, into the high school stuff. I love high school-themed TV shows. You know, like, I look back, and I was a total dork in high school. And maybe that's why it's sort of like wish fulfillment. Like, all the stuff that I didn't do in high school, I can, like, live through that in these books, which
right.
is kind of fun.
Rewrite the high school narratives. Well, I have a theory. Yeah. High school, right, we were all awkward in high school. I have a theory that everyone worth knowing as an adult really had a rough time of high school. That's why.
Well, you know, yeah, I think so, because you had to push through that.
Right. Right. And, there, you know, there's people that are like, oh, those were the best years of my life. I'm like, really? How in the world were those the best years of your life?
They were agonizing.
They were agonizing. Absolutely. We are talking with young adult author Julie Hammerly about her first book and her book that just came out this week, which is the first in a series. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the other books in that series and what we can expect from them, and also a little bit about writing and the writerly way and all that good stuff. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth hanging with you today until 3 o'clock. Thanks for being with us. It is so lovely outside. I hope you have downloaded your WGN Radio app and you are listening while outside enjoying the sunshine, because holy moly, it is so lovely out there. Go enjoy it. Enjoy it. My friends, we are talking with young adult author Julie Hammerly. She is a writing machine is what she is. And she had the book Sound of Us that came out not that long ago. And just this week, another book has come out. It is the first in a series. It is called Any Boy But You. I can't say that title, Julie, without saying Any Boy. Like,
my husband goes, is like, is it really Any Boy? Like Donald Trump, would he be okay?
Right. Really, Any Boy?
Yeah. I was right. Like, well, maybe if she thought about it, there'd be other ones who'd be worse. But.
Right. Okay. Any Boy, but maybe Any Boy, but that guy. Right.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, it is the first in the series set in North Pole, Minnesota, this holiday-themed city that is year-round holiday. So what can we expect? I know you just turned in edits for the next one, and this first one just came out this week, but what can we expect in the rest of the series?
So they're all set in their Christmas themed town. Kind of the weird thing about this series is I wrote them in order 2, 3, 1. So the first one was actually the third one I wrote. So it's sort of weird. We just kind of, like, I had the Christmas one, which comes out in October, and it's actually like a Christmas book. I wrote it kind of to be like a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Okay.
Like a young adult novel version of a Hallmark Christmas movie. So that one comes out at the end of the year. And then the one that comes out in July is set in the summertime. And so it's sort of like in a golf resort, like just outside North Pole. And one of the locals falls for like the new girl in town. And it's very sweet. I wrote that one actually like 6 years ago and have sort of edited it to fit into the series.
I think that's so interesting. I love to talk with authors about not only the order of writing books, but their writing process. And this is very interesting to me to hear you say that you wrote that 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And what did you originally envision for that book when you wrote it 6 years ago? Did you envision it being part of a series or no?
Oh, no, not at all. It was a kind of an homage to one of my favorite book series. I don't know if you like the Maude Hart Lovelace. Mm-hmm. Betsy Casey books, they are from like the turn of the last century.
Yeah.
One of them that's kind of like not as well known is called Carney's House Party. And it's about like all these people that end up in a kind of a resort town having the summer together, like friends. So it started out as sort of an homage to that book. And it was just from the point of view of the female character, the main girl in the book. But for this series, I had to do dual point of view. So then I had to like add the guy's point of view. And so it was really enlightening too. I came to like love the male character having gone back and rewritten it. So the next book, I have such affection for the two main characters. They're really, really wonderful. And it was kind of cool to go through it and see everything from his perspective.
I think writing processes are so, so very interesting. Do you, when you sit down to write, do you let the characters lead you or do you plan out? Do you make outlines or something like that?
It's like a combo. I do a lot of planning and, you know, I'll put my little board with my post-it notes and really kind of figure out where I want the plot to go. But I do let the characters lead it, because if I get to a point where I feel like I'm really stuck, you know, or I find myself like not wanting to write, I'm like, I'll know right away I'm going the wrong direction.
Mm.
Like it's supposed to do something else.
Yeah. Yeah. That is an interesting tell for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And then what else about what writing rituals do you have? Or, you know, I think a lot of people have a book in them. You know, a lot of people dream about writing a book and, you know, what advice would you give to them for getting that work done and getting that book out into the world?
Just do it. I think like, one of my favorite bits of advice that I've heard recently is you can't fix nothing.
I love
you
that.
You have to write something. And I wrote, so I wrote The Sound of Us almost 8 years ago. And I had a one-year-old, and I was babysitting my two-month-old niece. So I was not, it wasn't like I had nothing going on in my life. But I would sit down every single day when they were napping, and I would just write. And so I knocked that out in a month. I mean, it was terrible. It was awful. And over the next several years, I just kept working on it and working on it and working on it. But, you know, I think it's just a matter of doing it. Like, have you heard of NaNoWriMo? I'm sure you've.
Yes, the National Book Writing Month, where you where you spend the month of November furiously writing a novel.
Yeah, and there's like books out there that, you know, write your novel in a month or whatever. And that's what I did. I didn't do actual NaNoWriMo for The Sound of Us, but it was basically I'd gotten one of those write a book in a month books. And just kind of followed along with what I was supposed to do and just did it.
Well, I think that's very sound advice. I think there's a lot of power in just getting it done. I think sometimes if we stop ourselves and censor ourselves before we've even written the sentence, we'll shut it down. We won't do it. We won't get
right.
it done. I love that, though. You cannot fix what does not exist. Exactly.
Yeah.
I love that a lot. And, you know, you use a lot of social media, and a lot of people you know, you hear a lot of people saying, especially on Twitter and Facebook, people go, oh, well, I would love to write a book and sell it, but I don't have that big of a platform. And I think there's, you know, certainly been a shift towards authors that have already built a bit of an audience. And, you know, what is the role that social media plays for you as an author?
You know, I wouldn't say like I have a huge following or anything. There are some people that have a ton. I had a little bit, and I've been blogging for like 10, 12 years, something like that. So I know my way around the social media, but especially for fiction, the book's the most important thing. So worry about that. If you want to write a novel, then do that, then worry about the social media stuff. I think nonfiction, it's different. If you want to break into that, then you do need a platform. But it's great as far as like getting to know other writers or even getting to know agents and publishers and all that stuff, like to be on Twitter and just to see them as people is really kind of nice. It makes the world feel a little bit smaller and a little more accessible.
Truly, truly. Well, I was just about to say one thing that's so great about following you on Twitter is that you are so real. And I think there's this expectation. It used to be that authors were, you know, kind of up on the mountain and you could maybe write them a fan letter and they might write back or something. But now I think there's an expectation of a two-way conversation with journalists and authors and artists and things like that. And the people that you see connecting with their readers the most are people who are just very genuine on Twitter. And I think you do a really great job of just being you.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I think it's refreshing, right? Because I think sometimes that's a misstep that I think, you know, you'll see with authors. They'll just every couple of hours tweet, hey, buy my book.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, here's my book. Here it is again. Here's a sentence from my book. Hey, here's a video of me holding my book.
Oh, yeah. And I really try, and I need to be better at this too, but I try to promote other people's stuff too. Like I want to elevate other people that I know are doing good work as well.
Which is,
you know, I think that's super important because no one else is going to tweet your stuff if you're not tweeting theirs. So it's like, you have to be a little bit giving as well.
For sure. It's very much a two-way street, and I think there's a, you know, an effort bank there on social media that people remember when you say, hey, I just read so-and-so's book and I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think things like that count really, really big. Okay, so everybody, head out, go pick up Sound of Us if you have not already read that. It's got this beautiful purpley cover. It's very, very pretty. And then go get the new book, Any Boy But You. It is the first in the North Pole, Minnesota series, all by Julie Hammerly. And of course, follow her on social media, connect with her there. You're just at Julie Hammerly. And of course, I'll tweet out links to all your stuff and put that up at WGNRadio.com when the podcast is ready. Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Have a lovely Saturday. Enjoy this bizarrely May weather.
I know, we're spring cleaning. It's so weird.
I know. I keep saying, like, God forbid it gets cold again, because we're all going to be real crabby about that.
Oh, yeah.
Indeed. All right. Well, enjoy the rest of your weekend, Julie. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right, we are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are talking with some theater folks that are doing some really, really, really cool things. It's all big performance hour coming up here on 720 WGN, so stick around for that. Back in just a bit, 720 WGN.
I want more than anything to see proudly plump, fat, meaty, bodacious, curvy, sex-positive women become commonplace as love interests and leads on screen and on film.
Can the lead not be mixed race? Can they not be genderqueer? Can we not make theater about people of color and voices that sound like us?
I created this life for myself. No one helped me, and no one gets to decide whether I live out my life on stage.
720 WGN. What you were just hearing is all from the trailer for a new production from Collaboraction, and it is called Gender Breakdown. Here's the story with it, right? According to a recent study, only 25% of the plays produced in Chicago's 2015 to 2016 theater season had female authors. You already know what I'm going to say about that, right? So here is a group of folks that said, let's just do something about that. So Gender Breakdown is a production that is all about women and a female production team and women on stage and all kind of stuff, telling stories, doing powerful things. And so to discuss that with us, we have with us Erica Vannon, who is the director. We have Brianna Buckley, who is a cast member. And we have Kate Hallbaker-Crone, who is a cast member and dramaturge. Thanks so much for being with us. Let me turn on everybody's microphone. Hello and welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey there.
Tell me about this project and what led you to it. Whoever would like to start. Let's say Kate.
Yeah. Tell us about the project and what led us to it. Well, I guess.
Lots of things.
Lots of things. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know really where to start. So, Erica.
I can jump in with the origin a little bit.
Just give us a little there.
So, Collaboraction actually gratefully sort of gave us this platform last year in January to do a sketchbook, and we created a piece called Spanx You Very Much, which included 50 female-identifying performers dancing on stage all around the topic of Spanx. Mm-hmm. And after that show, Anthony Mosley was very excited to possibly have us come back and create something larger. And so at the time, the playwright, Danny Bryant, and I, we were participating in the female-identifying one-minute play festival that was coming through Chicago, and we had a social practice dinner with the directors, female-identifying directors and female-identifying playwrights, and we asked the question, what's working in Chicago and what's not working in Chicago? And the we kind of did a whiteboard about it, and the whiteboard around what's working filled up about one page, and the whiteboard around what's not working filled up about four or five pages.
I was going to say, how much time do you have?
Right. And it went on and on. And one of the sort of questions that launched this one of the statements that launched this project was, I want to say it was Chika Ike. I can't remember who said it, but someone said that the ensemble model in Chicago is actually broken, that even though it's sort of what we're known for in Chicago, Steppenwolf and building ensembles to create storefront theater, that they're actually very they're not very inclusive, the ensemble model, because you have, sure, a group of people that get together and they get to create something together. They get to write and direct and act. But if it's starting with basically a white male, cisgendered, usually straight men creating these companies, the stories that they tell are not don't often go beyond what that group knows. And so we thought that was interesting, and Collaboraction came back to us and said, here's a whole big slot in our season, make something, which we thought was really kind and generous of them. And so we did. And Danny and I thought, well, the first thing we need to do is find an intersectional cast of female identifying performers and let them make the story. So
for sure,
that's where they can pick up and talk about it. Right.
And the show itself is, it's a series of stories, but they're all based on real experiences.
Yeah. So the piece is a devised theater piece in its nature, which basically means there is a core team that has the topic and solidifies the curation of it, and then they get together a group of theater makers. And so when we first entered the rehearsal room, there wasn't a script. And so what Danny and Erica do is, what they did is gave our intersectional ensemble, which what an intersectional ensemble means is that we have varying gender expressions. Like, I'm a gender nonconforming individual. You can't see me on the radio, but like, I present non-traditionally when it comes to what gender is perceived as being. We also have all kinds of women of color, different cultural backgrounds, different ages, that kind of thing. And so all of those stories in one room, based on the exercises generated by Danny and Erica, brought these personal narratives out of us. And then within, you know, talking to each other and learning about each other, themes and motifs sprung up. There are commonalities amongst what female identified and gender nonconforming people experience. And so, yes, our stories are anchored in the arts and in theater, but what's important about what we're talking about is that folks in all kinds of industries experience what we're talking about on our stage. So when people come to this show, which I really hope you do, I think everybody can get something from it, you will be able to find experiences that happen to you in the corporate world, that happen to you in your church community, that happen wherever groups of people interact with each other. There are stereotypes at work, and there are impressions of what it means to interact with certain people, and that often does a disservice to the actual stories and experiences at hand. Generalizations are problematic. And so what this show does is sort of unpacks that in a really accessible way that makes something really uncomfortable to talk about incredibly digestible and relatable, which is something I'm proud of that we put up on this stage, is we took really, you know, a really hot topic and I think produced something not only entertaining in a humor, like there's humor, there's you'll cry a little, you'll laugh a little. We have a hybrid genres.
It's fun too, right? There's parts of it that are actually fun to perform.
Yeah.
Right. And that we had someone comment last night about, like, that I was the one on the front row that was laughing hysterically and then crying, you know, in the next scene.
Yeah. You laugh, you cringe, you cry all in one scene. Yes.
That's good. That's what we wanted. And I like what you're saying about accessibility, right? Because I think so often if we say we need to discuss this topic, mm-hmm. people will kind of go, oh, I know there's a lot to it, or they'll clam up, or they'll shut down, or they'll, you know, lots of different reactions with that. And, you know, I think often about the role comedy plays in that and the role that art plays in that, you know, especially right now when we're having big conversations. I think we can all agree, no matter how you voted, no matter how your politics lie, there's a lot going on right now. And there's a lot of conversations that we've been having in the last, I don't know, few months even. I was going to say year, but shorter than that even, that were just things we had not talked about in a very, very long time. So what was that process like of getting the show together and coming up with these themes that you were saying? And, you know, what I have to assume there had to have been a lot of, you know, emotional vulnerability and a lot going on with that.
Yeah, no, I was going to say I'm the type of human that emotions are kind of interesting for. I don't necessarily always want to share those, especially not knowing the space and situation I'm in. But I think one of the biggest things that I even mentioned to Danny while like doing one of our personal sessions was that too many people are afraid to allow others to be uncomfortable because they feel like that is something that is a negative thing, where it's like, it's good for you to feel uncomfortable because that's when you start to understand that, oh crap, red flag in myself, right? So like, what does that say about me, mm-hmm. that I am the one that's making it seem like they're making me uncomfortable, when all in all it's usually the other way around, where it's like, hey, actually the actions that you have taken in this manner have made me feel uncomfortable, and you are just uncomfortable with it now being brought up because you just want to hide it. And by not saying those things, it doesn't help. It makes it so that those things keep piling up, right? And then it's like, holy crap, there's all these things we need to talk about. Where do we start? And it's like, well, you need to start by understanding that being uncomfortable is something that is a good thing. It's something that you can work with. And by understanding that you are uncomfortable, that's where you're going to start kind of seeing the things that are wrong in order to change those.
Yeah. I mean, I think culturally, right, we have this aversion to discomfort. We want to, you know, the first sign of a headache, we want that Advil. We don't want to say, maybe I'm sitting weirdly or I'm really stressed out. We just go, I need drugs or whatever. You know, we avoid discomfort. And I think that's a really excellent point that we, plus I think too, as women, right, I think there's like this expectation of female behavior that's like going to smooth things out.
You're never allowed to have an off day.
No.
Yeah.
As a woman existing in the world, you can never have an off day. And I think that that's, I don't think that that's okay, because I think that's not a reality. I think that, yes, gender is constantly at play in our society. Sure. Yes, race is constantly at play in our society. But I think that when people stop being afraid of each other and actually listen to each other and sit in their own discomfort, real learning can happen. And until people are ready to listen to somebody's experience that they otherwise have no motivation to be interested in.
Right, like it doesn't benefit them.
It doesn't benefit you from listening or learning from this person, but it will, you know, that's I think where change begins. When you're like, well, why am I not interested? Oh, I'm going to show up to this play and listen to stories that I otherwise never would have encountered, and then start seeing things a little bit differently. Start seeing these narratives in other places, or not seeing them and asking yourself, well, they did it at this scrappy little theater company in Wicker Park, Bucktown, with, you know, in this tiny theater where we just like blow a crater in the stage. Why can't someone else with so many more resources, so much more publicity, make the effort to create a pipeline for giving these narratives space that aren't usually given space?
Indeed. So we're talking about the production Gender Breakdown. It's going to be at The Vault at Collaboration Studios in the Flatiron Arts Building. That's 1579 North Milwaukee Avenue. It's in Wicker Park. Go to collaboration.org. We are talking with Erica, Brianna, and Kate from that production, all about how it came to be, what is at stake, why it matters, all those things. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to continue this conversation here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth with you till 3 o'clock. This hour, we are talking all about the arts, in particular performance arts. And there is a real awesome thing happening over at the Collaboration Studios in the Flatiron Arts Building. That's at 1579 North Milwaukee. You can read all about it. Collaboration, like action and collaboration, had a baby, guys. Collaboration.org, or you can call 312-226-9633. And the show is called Gender Breakdown. Know why? Here's why. Because according to a recent study, only of about a quarter of the plays produced in Chicago's 2015 to 2016 season had female authors. Y'all already know how I feel about that. We gotta not be doing that. So this group of folks got together to make this piece of art with true, absurd, uncomfortable, and gut-punchingly real stories from more than 200 Chicago theater artists. So there's lots of themes. There's lots of stuff. And before the break, we were talking about how some themes emerged despite great diversity and intersectionality within the cast and in the production crew. A lot of universal human themes emerge. So we're here talking with Erica Vannon, who is the director of this here fine production. We're talking with Brianna Buckley, who is a cast member, and Kate Hallbaker-Crone, a cast member and dramaturge, all here hanging out in studio today. Thank you so much for being here today.
Of course. Thanks for having us.
So as we talk about the production and the things that we're taking on, and I'm saying we, because I've just made myself like an honorary
member
of this, because I'm definitely going for sure. I might be super fangirl and be there a lot, but nonetheless, tell me about some of the things in particular that you know, as you're talking about these true stories and these big narratives, what are some of the things we can expect to see on stage in these stories?
Sure. I'm going to lob it your way. Don't worry. So one of the first things that really came out of our initial discussions was we all had a different experience with similar occurrences at school. So one of our sections, we call them tracks. We're not okay. calling them scenes. We call them tracks.
Got it.
Is about undergraduate college experiences, which that's Bree's
yeah.
scene.
Yeah, I came up with that one. Yeah. That was the one that kind of hit close to home the most, I think, in just understanding kind of my own personal stories and struggles of feeling like who I am as a Black woman, not actually being able to see myself right in anything. So like mm-hmm. when it comes to school, where it's like, oh, okay, so these are all the fine, wonderful people that you're going to be learning about. And you're like, well, great, we can do Shakespeare all day, but like, where am I? Because that's not written for me, right? So like, mm-hmm. where are the stories that are about me? Where are the stories that make my life resonate and that resonate with me, where I can connect to that and go, oh, great, like this is about me, right? This is about my blood and my soil and where I came from. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you don't really see that when you are growing up in a program that is supposed to be there to help better educate you and help you learn about yourself and really tap into those things of being an artist, if that's what you want to do, or being a doctor, if that's what you want to do, right? Like, it kind of doesn't matter what field you're necessarily going in. For me, it was more of just understanding and recognizing that the place that's supposed to uplift me and educate me the most is one of the places that I feel unseen, not heard, where there is no other human or nothing else accessible that I can say that that's like me, right? Like, I can see me in that.
Sure.
There's another scene that happens that Siobhan Reddy Best is a part of, where she talks about Juno Diaz quote.
Yes.
In there not being enough, there not being a reflection of who she is, that she's not seeing enough mirrors around. To talk about Bree's point, that there's not enough representation of showing people like Bree, people like Siobhan, people like Kate, people like everyone in our production, that they have enough of representation or people that look like them out in the arts to make them feel like, hey, I can do right. this too.
Or to piggyback off of that, Siobhan Reddy Best shares this scene with Priya Mohanty, who speaks about being stereotyped within her race. Mm-hmm. So it's like, yes, she's seen, but she's cast as a doctor or a celebrity stalker or a terrorist.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then also because of Priya's age within the theater world, like if you're 30, you're quote unquote past your prime. So Priya's experienced being cast as so many variations of mom.
Mothers, yeah.
Which, you know, motherhood is a beautiful, complicated thing. But when that's all people view women as being, that gets into a generalization that, like I was speaking to earlier, is problematic to generalize folks in that manner. And so we're trying to put up some cultural mirrors and allow folks of color and gender nonconforming folks to actually see themselves represented on stage. And one of them, to keep going, one of my favorite scenes to perform is our audition scene, where we use the language from real audition calls posted online that we all gathered, and we perform a game show concept. And on stage, like, I'm in a vest and a bow tie and I look great. But as I'm performing this scene, none of the calls are for me, which is why I'm the mouthpiece of giving the calls, because I don't answer any of them. None of them are for someone who looks like me. Which it's all, you know, long hair, you know, these fashion descriptions instead of like sexy, right? Great bodies
and all around body image. So it's really all of the descriptors of what makes you, I'm doing air quotes here, female,
right?
That you're looking for. So it's never sort of the you know, a lot of men get breakdowns that are like, he's smart or untouchable
which is ridiculous for a theater or performing organization to call people into their room without giving them any emotional motivation for their audition. How do women even audition when what we're given is, you have to wear this outfit?
Yeah.
What? How do I play? How do I play sexy? How do I play pencil skirt? How do I play high-waisted umpire waist A-line? Right. How do I play
deeply feeling a pencil skirt? Right.
Right. Right.
Yes.
So,
very, very important point. So, this is happening in Chicago. Go see it. Take people you know to go see it. It is Gender Breakdown, presented at The Vault at Collaboration Studios in the Flatiron Arts Building, 1579 North Milwaukee. It's right there in Wicker Park, right there. Real easy to get to, public transportation, all that good stuff. No excuses. Single tickets are 20 to 30 or 10 to 15 bucks for students, educators, and industry folks. For tickets and info, go to collaboration.org or call 312-226-9633. And I'm going to be tweeting this out, and we'll also put it on the WGN radio page once the podcast of this show is up, so you will not miss it. And what are the dates? It opens
next Wednesday, which I believe is the 22nd. We're in previews right now, which audiences are also welcome to attend. But I don't believe press is invited until next Wednesday, so our reviews won't start coming out till after then.
Excellent.
So we're already rolling. We're excited. Come see it now.
Come see it tonight, 7:30.
Yeah, 7:30 tonight. And this is also the kind of show, like, yes, we're talking about theater and theater artists at you know, its marketing will relate most strongly to it, but I also encourage educators to come out as well. We've had a lot of teachers in the audience so far that are like, you know, they want us to bring it into a school. Like, it's something that, you know, anybody who is in a relational profession in the corporate world,
gotta see
in
it.
The service industry, you gotta come see it. It's not just for theater people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it runs until March. I just had it in front of me. March 13th, right? Yeah. I have a feeling it's going to get extended. I have a feeling. But nonetheless, Erica Vannon, Brianna Buckley, and Kate Hallbaker-Krohn, thank you so much for being with us. Good luck on the show. Or break a leg. Sorry, didn't mean to say good luck. Break a leg. Do all the things. And we will see you from the audience. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. I've been 20 WGN. It's Amy Guth with you till 3 o'clock, at which time we shall turn things over to Mark Carmen and Harry Tynowitz for the beat, for all the sports things that you can possibly talk about. So, as promised, this hour we have been talking about awesome art stuff, performance art in particular, things happening right here in Chicago for really, really fantastic causes and doing cool things. We were just talking with the collaboration group that's behind the show Gender Breakdown. And now, please welcome to the studio James Spalding and Ashley J. Hicks, who are part of the Chicago Actors Call to Action. It's an organization that directs resources through fundraising, performances, and other means to social causes. And they have got an event coming up. It is tomorrow. And please tell us all about what you're doing and all that and what we can expect from this event tomorrow.
Okay. I have to correct you, I'm afraid. My name is actually James Spalding, but
Well,
you said Spalding, but
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Typos occur.
So tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Promontory down in Hyde Park,
which is so gorgeous.
Oh, it's an amazing venue.
I love that venue.
It's huge, and they've got a beautiful restaurant downstairs and this huge performance space upstairs, which we're hoping to fill, and a great bar, and it's just great. And so we're doing a benefit concert to support NAACP, specifically the Chicago Southside branch, and they're actually providing some of the entertainment, which is fantastic. But generally, it's actors and musicians from across Chicago, who mainly black musicians and actors for this one, and so they're just going to perform, sing, do sections from the work they're doing at the moment. Ash is doing something from her one-woman show, which is going up next week.
Next Saturday, actually. It's so funny that Collaboration was here, because my show will also be a part of that Gender Breakdown process.
Worlds collide.
Yay! But my show, Beautifully Broken, will be premiering here in Chicago with Impact Solo Jams. And it's one-woman show. I'm actually really excited to perform a piece of it for the benefit tomorrow. Basically just highlights my experience as a black artist with albinism. So I'm really excited to share it with the event. It should be really fun.
Yeah, we're really excited. And we're so happy that we've got so many actors and musicians who are happy to give up their Sunday nights, which are kind of precious, and give of their time for free to make a really, hopefully, a really good show.
So how many people are involved in this production tomorrow?
So we've got, I think, probably about 12, 13 performers, something like that, about four or five singers, including the wonderful Lynn Jordan, who does basically a fantastic Nina Simone act. She's doing Mississippi Goddam, and that's going to be awesome. We've got a couple of actors from Porchlight's Scottsboro Boys, which is just opened a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Denzel and Joss. I'm a little hesitant because I'm actually the beneficiaries manager, so I'm not completely au fait with all the talent we have tomorrow.
And there's a lot, it sounds like.
There's a lot. Yeah. There's an awful lot.
Yeah, there's a lot. There are some really great people. You know, the Chicago theater community is very small. It's like such a small pond. And as I was going through the list of all of the people that were performing, I'm like, oh my God, I know all of them. Right. And they're
worked
all
with you,
great.
Worked with you, worked with you.
Or seen you in a show,
Right. And that's one of my favorite things about Chicago theater. There's just this kind of like, we can do this and figure it out kind of pull it along together sort of way. And every time I have theater groups on the air to talk about a production, it's always a crossover. It always, someone will mention something they just did. And I said, oh, they were on last night or what, without fail, you realize all these connections that are just so, so wonderfully deep and so lovely. And so tell me about the process of getting this show together. So the Chicago Actors Call to Action takes on a lot of causes and supports a lot of different efforts. So tell me about getting the show together for this one in particular.
So we decided, so our first event was last month for Planned Parenthood, and we raised over $2,000 for them. We had an event at the On Common Ground restaurant on Devon, and we thought, since this month is Black History Month and there's a lot of awareness about black issues at the moment for lots of extremely good reasons, that NAACP was going to be our beneficiary this month. And we got in touch with Rose Joshua, attorney Rose Joshua, who's the, I think her title is president, but she's head of the Southside NAACP. And they were really on board. And they were like, yeah, can we do it on the Southside? Can we get a venue down there? We'll bring our membership there. And so it sort of starts around that. Not necessarily what the beneficiary, they don't control where it is, but they have great input. So that they're actually in the show, they're going to have, there's a group they run for schools called CHILL, which is a de-escalation program, so you're in the school ground and things are getting out of hand, and they show how, in a funny way, how to just walk away and go down the other route. Mm. Or, for example, meeting a police officer and taking the heat out of it. And so we're really pleased to have them. They've also got a young pianist called Charles Morgan, who went through it's called their Olympics program. It's ACT SO, which I think is something cultural technology, something Olympics, which basically helps black youths get into science, technology, and the arts. And this kid's come through their program and is now a performing pianist. So he's gonna do a piece of, he hasn't decided yet. It's either going to be a Bach prelude or a Chopin waltz.
Oh, wow. I would love to possess the musical skills to be like, I don't know if I'm going to play a Chopin waltz or a Bach prelude. I just don't know. I'll decide tomorrow. Game time decision.
Yeah.
I have no idea what it would be like to possess those kind of skills, but I can only admire those who do, because that's really lovely. So it sounds like there's just going to be a little of everything.
A little of everything. Yeah, we've got some
theater.
Slam poetry.
Cool.
Yeah. A little of everything, I think. Yeah, it's going to be a tremendous amount of fun. And I haven't given the time out yet, have I?
Please do. I want to know about time and tickets.
Okay. So it's 7:30 tomorrow night at the Promontory. Doors open at 7. Tickets are $20 on the door or online. You can go to our website, which is caca.group. That's actually the domain name. Tickets are on there. More about the performers, or more about the cause, what we're doing, why we're doing it, is all on the website.
Excellent. All right. We are talking with James Sparling and Ashley J. Hicks, who are part of the Chicago Actors Call to Action. They're doing this show that he was just talking about, just giving that info for, caca.group, $20, doors at 7 tomorrow at the Promontory. It is benefiting the Southside chapter of NAACP. So you definitely want to check this out. Super interesting. It's all put together by Chicago Actors Call to Action. We're going to take a little break, but when we come back, we will talk more about this organization and other work that they're doing here in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth with you till 3 o'clock when we turn things over to Mark Harmon and Harry Tynowitz for The Beat, talking about all things sports. So you definitely want to stick around for that. But right now we are talking with James Sparling and Ashley J. Hicks from Chicago Actors Call to Action. They have a benefit that is happening tomorrow night at the Promontory in Hyde Park. If you have not been to that space, do yourself a favor and go to it. It is so beautiful. It is such a cool space, and they do really, really cool things there. Tomorrow night will be no exception. The benefit tomorrow is for the Southside chapter of the NAACP. So this organization, the Chicago Actors Call to Action, basically picks different social causes and will fundraise through performances and other expressions of art, which is very, very cool. So tell us about how this organization came to be, and it sounds you just did the first event just a month or so ago, so
that's right.
It sounds fairly new.
It is. So it was all inspired by our director Lee Wichman watching John Oliver's show last December, and where after the interesting events that happened earlier that year in November.
We won't say which. We'll just say
some interesting things
happened in November. Which people had some feelings about.
People had, and we had feelings, and John Oliver had feelings. And it struck Lee that John Oliver's call to do something about it, to channel this confusion and anger and fear, to actively stand up and do something. And Lee is also an actor and thought, well, what can we do? We're actors, right? We can do something together using the power of storytelling, the fact that us actors are embedded in this city all over the place. We're everywhere. And if we could draw that together to get people to do something rather than just post on Facebook, like, what can I actually do? And not just to help organizations through money, not just because actors don't have any money, but to actually you do something. So what? Every time we get a beneficiary on board, we say, give us some active points. Give us some action points. Give us things we can actually do. Can we ring somebody up? Can we help out in a homeless shelter? Can we, you know, actors have funky schedules and at times...
That could be a benefit
sometimes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Time on their hands. And so that was Lee's idea. And we'd have monthly benefits for different organizations. We're doing one next month on the 20th of March for the ACLU. They're very happy to be partnering with us. We're moving on to Green Issues in April with the, I have to get the name right, the Natural Resource Defense Council, who are just down in the Lyric Opera Building.
Mm-hmm.
And they're partnering with us in April for its Earth Day. Gay organizations, or rather LGBT organizations.
For Pride Month in June.
Pride Month in June. We've got homeless at Christmas, homeless charities, mental health organizations in May. So that kind of thing, yeah. Having monthly events around the city. People have been very generous, like donating their venues or giving us cut price deals on venues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, having a lot of fun all the while and trying to grow it. We've got 1,000 people on our Facebook page who are all keen to do something, you know, just say, this is what you can do. It may be just sending a postcard to your senator. It may be, as I say, standing on a street corner. But actively standing up is our kind of slogan, to
sure.
do something.
And what about non-actors who just want to support the organization? Do you recommend connecting on Facebook and just attending events? Or is there more that you would like the layperson to do?
Well, I mean, this applies kind of to everyone. I mean, really, the benefits ideally are the chance for the actors to put on something for ideally non-actors, you know, mm-hmm. people around the city who want to see a great show and feel they can help. So there is a public Facebook group, CACA, Chicago Actors Call to Action. I think you can just look it up and you should find it and then link to it. And that'll give you action points to, if you've got time in your day to, you know, spend 5 minutes on the phone or sending a postcard or whatever.
Sure.
So yes, we're reaching out. We're using our vast network to reach beyond our own acting bubble, as it were.
Excellent. Yeah. And I'll be sure and share that link on my own social media. And also we will link to it at WGNRadio.com once the podcast of this show is out. So you can connect there with Chicago Actors Call to Action if you would like to do so. So Ashley, your show, your one woman show that is coming up here very, very soon.
Yes.
That is going to be part of this event tomorrow night at the Promontory.
Yes.
Tell us a little more about your show.
Well, Beautifully Broken is, wow, I started writing like 10 years ago in college.
I feel like that's always the way with one person shows. It's always like, well, like 20 years ago, this happened.
Yeah, no, it was, 20 years ago this year, 10 years ago this year, actually. And it started off as this small monologue that I had done with another solo artist named Tim Miller. And he was like, you have to develop this more and more because it talked about my experience with albinism and the many hardships that I've had to deal with as a person with albinism, as a Black person with albinism. And I'm like, I don't have anything more to say than what I did. And he's like, no, you have way more to say. So about a year and a half ago, I finally sat down and just went through everything, and Beautifully Broken is what I came up with. So back in August, I actually got the opportunity to premiere it in St. Louis at the St. Louis Fringe Festival. And that was really, really great. I got to have all of my friends and my family because I'm originally from St. Louis. And then I got into the Impact Solo Jams Festival. And it gets to be here with all of my peers and, you know, people that I've worked with. So it's going to be pretty cool. I'm excited about it.
And so that is that starts up February 25th.
Yes, February 25th at the Greenhouse Theater at 11 p.m. I know it's a late show, but if you can't make that one, it will also be at Collaboration Space on March 3rd at 9:30 p.m.
We were just talking with the folks. Exactly. I did not even plan that. I did not even realize I was having like a collaboration day, but here we are.
So
that's very exciting. So that's March 3rd, you said?
March 3rd at 9:30.
Much more doable than 11 for some folks. Mm-hmm. Of course, us folks in radio, we're like, whatever. Just pour the coffee, I'll show up to the things anytime. And what are some of the themes that emerge in that show? You know, beyond the main theme, what, you know, what do you hope people walk away from the show thinking or maybe thinking about differently?
I think for me, obviously it's a very personal thing for me, but I also wanted to make sure that people could relate to it in their own way of having pieces of ourselves that may not necessarily be pretty. They're broken, they're bruised. They may not be popular or what everyone may consider normal, but they're beautiful and that we need to embrace them. And, you know, I guess in a way, let your freak flag fly.
It's one of my favorite expressions.
Yeah. So, you know, calling people to kind of take ownership and pride in our differences. So to be able to, you know, to bring it full circle, bring it back to the NAACP event and be able to share that with people I'm really, really excited.
How did you select what you're going to share tomorrow night?
That was fun. That was an interesting conversation with my director because it's such a movement heavy piece. And I found out, I'm like, okay, well, what is the stage going to look at like? And am I allowed to move? And am I going to be mic'd? And then I found out, oh, you're going to have a microphone. And I'm like, okay, well, I can't really move then. And then my director's like, no, I have the exact part you're going to do. This is going to be great. And it's actually, I don't want to give too much away, but it's actually talking about some of the atrocities that happen over in Africa to people who have albinism. Mm. And I relate it to an experience that I had in high school. So it should be a nice little educational
performance. Sure. A lot of things. I mean, it sounds like there's so much to take in and really experience tomorrow night at this event, including part of your show. And when you said my director, it struck me, it must be very vulnerable, perhaps a bit awkward, difficult, maybe liberating, question mark, to turn your life story over to another person.
It is. It's really strange. I'm an actor and I'm very used to telling other people's stories. But around the time that I first started writing this show, someone told me, they're like, the most important thing you can do as an artist is create your own work. You'll always have a job if you're creating your own work.
Totally agreed.
And so to give this work and give it to someone who by the way, I trust my director. He was my Meisner teacher for 2 years. He knows how to pull things out of me that I don't think anyone else can.
Sure.
But there had to be the conversation of, this is my show.
This is what I want to say.
And some things where he's like, you should totally talk about that. And I'm like, that's too much. I'm pulling back some. But it is very vulnerable to put your story into someone else's hands. But if they believe in it, and he does, and he's been on this roller coaster with me for like the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. And to have someone else believe in the vision that I have, because I honestly didn't think that I had anything interesting to say. And he's like, no, this is something, this is where your art lies. This is where the core of your work is.
You know, I have had so many people on this very station who are making incredible pieces of art or doing unthinkably cool things who have said that very thing, who have said, I didn't think I had anything interesting to say. I didn't think I could do it. It didn't occur to me I had this. And that strikes me so powerfully every time the people that are doing these really powerful pieces are at all points, everybody struggles with that kind of self-doubt of like, who am I to say that? You know, I think that's so powerful and interesting. And I would say that has been a thing that has echoed through all kinds of people, all different points in their career, all like there's no commonality to the people that have said that other than human. That's it.
Yeah,
I mean, it's really interesting how that echoes through, that if we could all just start admitting that to each other,
right?
Like, hey, you know what? We're all winging it. None of us know what we're doing. We're just winging it.
We're all trying to figure this out.
And no one gets out alive. Let's just do our best. I think we would get a lot further. Well, thank you so much, Ashley J. Hicks and James Sparling from Chicago Actors Call to Action. Go to this event tomorrow night. It is at the Promontory. It benefits the Southside chapter of the NAACP. Their next one is March 20th. That benefits the ACLU. You can find out more about it. Go to ChicagoActorsCTA.org. You can find them on Facebook. And again, I'm going to tweet these links out and I'll share them on Facebook. And we'll make sure they land on the WGN Radio show page once this show is archived in podcast form. Thank you so much for being with us today. And good luck, or break a leg. Sorry. Break a leg.
Thank you.
Tomorrow at
Thank
the
you
event.
So much.
And I hope that you pack the house.